This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, over the past 4 years, we've had several conversations about Ford Motor Company's blueprint for sustainability. And we like to revisit that every year because, frankly, the results every year are most compelling. And this year, we have the pleasure of inviting Thomas Niemann to the show. Thomas is the reporting manager for sustainability for the Ford Motor Company. Thomas, welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Well, it's good to be here, Dr. Heinze. Thank you for having me.
The blueprint for sustainability, probably, in my opinion, the paradigm sustainability plan that I've seen anyway, not only in corporate America, but anywhere. For our listeners who may not be familiar with it, a little background on the blueprint for sustainability, how it got started and how it's become embedded as part of the Ford Motor Company culture.
Well, first, I want to thank you for the compliment. We're very proud of our corporate sustainability report. And this is Ford Motor Company's 13th sustainability report. It actually started in 1999, and back then we called it our corporate social responsibility report instead of a sustainability report. And it is matured over time to reflect all the different things we now understand as sustainability. And then back in 2008, we changed the name of the report, if you will, gave it a subtitle called The Blueprint for Sustainability to reflect the fact that sustainability is an integral part of Ford Motor Company's business plan. So what the sustainability report does is really cover, if you'll forgive the pun, the waterfront of all the different activities that Ford Motor Company is doing, whether it's on our financial performance, whether it's on our societal performance, or whether it's on our environmental stewardship performance. And this report, and in fact, that's the subtitle of this year's report, is Accelerating Ahead, is the fact that we've really gained some traction in all three of those fronts in the efforts and initiatives and improvements that Ford Motor Company is trying to make. And the Blueprint for Sustainability is intended to share that story with people in a way that they can read it piece by piece.
Thomas, let's talk about some of those accomplishments in the past year. But actually, this first one has been ongoing over the last 6 years, and that's cutting your energy costs in terms of your vehicle manufacturing.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting because, you know, it's pretty well covered how well we've been doing in terms of our improved fuel economy performance of our products. What has been less publicized and even less talked about by us is the improvements that we've been making in our facilities. And quite honestly, that journey began with our updates to the Rouge factory facility, and we learned lots of lessons there, and we were able to crosswalk some of those over to new facilities. And as we've updated them over time and so forth, and working with partners and so forth. But it's really a way of, it's some of the simple things. It's probably the same things your listeners do in their homes in terms of improving efficiencies, whether that's our heating and cooling systems, whether that's our lighting systems. The difference is for us, we have tools that we use in the manufacturing processes, and we've been updating those to more energy efficient tools. And certainly we're changing things like, some of our facilities are 50, 60, and 70 years old, so we've been converting many of them from inefficient steam-powered systems to direct-fired gas systems that improves that efficiency. And we've also actually taken our coal-burning facilities out of our manufacturing lineup and now have, within North America, strictly natural gas fired facilities and so forth in terms of either electricity generation or heating and cooling operations. So any number of things that we've been doing to improve those efficiencies, and now we get to talk about them.
Yeah, the conversion to natural gas looks like a stroke of genius given some of the recent developments in extraction of natural gas from shale may provide natural gas repositories for 100 to 200 years to come.
Well, I agree. We, you know, part of even as we look at our products, part of how we look at our facilities, our operations, a lot of that has to do with what can we do to reduce our carbon impact on the world. And And in that way, it also, what can we do to improve our bottom line because of the cost efficiencies that are achieved? But with natural gas in our facilities in particular, we take advantage of what is a very economic source of energy. And, you know, it's good that I work with people a lot smarter than me that can look to the future and see those trends and make those changes and program those plans into our out-year activities, which, by the way, some of those are still yet to come, even as we, for instance, improve our paint processes and so forth, where we either improving the efficiency of the paint process or we're capturing the emissions of the paint processes to fuel cells and use that for further generation, and then also that it reduces waste and the unfortunate byproducts of our paint processes, so yet it captures a waste stream and turns it into energy.
Well, you've cut costs by 22% over the past 6 years, but you've also set a goal of another 25% reduction on top of that over the next 5 years. So, I mean, yes, you have natural gas, but as you mentioned, Thomas, you're also looking at solar. You're looking at ways of turning paint solids into power. You're probably looking at all different possibilities in the future energy portfolio.
Oh, absolutely. So we have I believe it's a 500-watt solar panel photovoltaic system out at our Michigan assembly plant, which is ironically a place right now where we're building any number of our electrified vehicles. So we're using solar to offset the manufacture of those vehicles as well as to charge the vehicles for their initial final assembly charge up to get the batteries up to speed and going. So it's very interesting there. But we also do things like capturing landfill gas and even in places in Europe and so forth, we're using wind to augment our energy. And in some cases, we're generating enough that we have excess to sell back to the grid.
My guest is Thomas Niemann, who is the reporting manager for sustainability for the Ford Motor Company. Thomas, one thing I do like to talk about in the blueprint, and it's something that a lot of companies simply don't address, and that's social sustainability. You report that you've recently revised your Code of Human Rights and Basic Working Conditions and Corporate Responsibility, which applies not only to Ford Motor Company or Ford Motor Company here in the United States, but to your entire supply chain all over the world.
As proud as I am of our products and as proud as I am of our environmental stewardship, I may be most proud of how we set a standard for treating people. In fact, so that this is a standard that applies, as you pointed out, both inside the company and outside of the company. And we have processes and procedures in place to monitor it inside the company, and that we have the same things to teach our supply chain partners those same standards, and we have means of checking them, third-party verification, and so forth. So the update to this letter is very timely because it reflects some of the things the Ruggie Commission had in conjunction with its mandate from the United Nations to look at these things as a global issue and so forth. So, you know, all these great things we do for our world have to begin first with how we take care of people. And I'm very proud of the fact that we have a very robust and rigorous system in place to check, monitor, ensure that we're doing that.
Yeah, we can talk about recycling, energy reduction, all the great things, using recycled materials in your vehicles, turning paints into power, but treating people fundamentally, I mean, isn't that the ultimate test of sustainability?
It certainly is, because if we're not doing what we're doing for the betterment of people, then in my mind, it's kind of why are you doing it? And the fact that we have this policy in place, that it is not something that we had to think about doing, but it's in this instance, we updated a policy that we've had since almost 10 years now that allows us to then, again, set the example, set the standard, and then share it throughout our value chain and so that we have, you know, a shared value and a shared behavior so that, you know, all the great things we are doing in the end are for the benefit of the people, whether it's economical transportation or healthy communities or healthy families.
Thomas, we've had some of your colleagues on over the years, as you know, I'm always impressed by the passion with whomever I'm talking at Ford Motor Company. I like to ask this question to kind of conclude an interview. How is it that this ethos of sustainability and this that extends into human rights and the way we treat, how is it that it's become so much a part and parcel of the fabric of Ford Motor Company?
Well, I think very often it's kind of the old adage, an organization does well at what the boss checks. And I have the extreme good fortune of having two bosses, and I'm going to go right to the top of the food chain, and that would be Bill Ford and Alan Mulally. And the two of them set the tone, and they set the example. You know, since Bill has become chairman in 1999, it wasn't long after that the department that I'm in was created. And it wasn't long after that that the policy letter 24 came into existence. And then certainly if you have but to meet Alan Mulally and see how he values people, how he treats people, how he understands that a business successes are going to start first and foremost with their employees. And then in our case, as to how they treat their partners in that, and whether that's customers or suppliers, they both intuitively understand these things. So I have, and then they surround themselves with the good people that have those shared values and shared beliefs. So, and then as you mentioned, you've talked to some of my associates, which actually are my boss and my boss's boss, both Sue Siski and John Vieira have also been guests on your show. But even as Sue has retired this year and she's been replaced by this wonderful man by the name of Robert Brown, you know, the value, the belief is still there. It's not something that he has to think about. It's already how he values employees and how he values the equitable treatment of people. So I'm just very fortunate that from the very top of the organization right on down through there, that this is a value that is just second nature to the company, and it makes me very proud to work here and be associated with what we do.
Well, it's the 13th Annual Sustainability Report from the Ford Motor Company. It's entitled Blueprint for Sustainability, Accelerating Ahead. I would imagine, Thomas, that people could simply Google that or the blueprint or Ford Motor Company and find a PDF.
Oh, they sure could. In fact, it's a very lengthy report. It is literally the Ford Motor Company's story to a level of detail that will probably surprise lots of folks. But yes, there's also a nice 8-page, what we call executive summary of it, that when you go into the report that you can find it pretty easily. And you'd find it through our corporate.ford.com website. And if you just think go sustainability, that will get you to the rest of the report.
And as one who's read the last four or five of those, actually about the last four since they came out, in, I think beginning, like you said, in 2008, those executive summaries are excellent reading and kind of compelling to read the whole thing after you read the executive summary. I've been talking with Thomas Nieman, who is reporting manager for sustainability for the Ford Motor Company. Thomas, thank you for your time and congratulations to Ford on continued success on sustainability front.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for letting me share that story with you today.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Our mission is to be your personal network for life.
Scott Westerman leads the Michigan State University Alumni Association.
The best reason to become a certified Spartan by joining the MSU Alumni Association is the network of 500,000 Spartans that are out there that we can connect you with.
Join the Michigan State University Alumni Association online at alumni.msu.edu.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
We're in Ann Arbor this week for the beginning of the third stage of the 2012 American Solar Challenge, a competition to design, build, and drive solar-powered cars over a 1,200 to 1,500-mile course between several cities across the United States.
There were 12 colleges and university teams from the U.S. and abroad that qualified for this year's challenge, including the University of Michigan and Western Michigan University, and counting team members, observers, and staff, about 230 people travel with this event. One of the major sponsors of the American Solar Challenge is Black & Veatch, a global leader in engineering, consulting, and construction that specializes in several areas, including energy. This third stage of the American Solar Challenge is also hosted by the University of Michigan and the City of Ann Arbor. It's my pleasure to welcome a couple of dignitaries from Black & Veatch, who are major sponsors of the American Solar Challenge. We have Dean Oskvig, who is president of Black & Veatch Energy, and Kurt Westerman, senior vice president, director of renewables and energy efficiency business at Black & Veatch. And Dean Kurt, welcome to Greening the Great Lakes. A pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Dean, let's start. How is it that Black & Veatch became involved in the American Solar Challenge in the first place?
Well, it started out with one of our professionals who's personally involved in renewable energy and particularly in the transportation area as a personal advocacy. He identified to us this event, and working through Kurt, he identified that we had an opportunity to both be a sponsor and then a host for the start of the third stage. So that's how we got involved. Monetarily, we contributed through our Building a World of Difference Foundation, which lines up with health and human services programs and services, educational programs and services, environmental programs and services, and safety and security sort of services. So that's how we got involved.
I did a little bit of background. Oh, Dean, Kurt, you'd like to add something to that?
Yeah, I'd like to add a few words. You know, this competition requires a tremendous amount of teamwork and innovation on the part of the racing teams, and we think that it strongly parallels the dedication and commitment that these racing teams are making is similar to how our employees come together to work on technically challenging and engineering solutions for our clients.
Well, I ask you both this question. I would imagine this is a great venue to meet young people and to maybe identify some future employees for Black & Veatch.
It is, and I want to add on to what Kurt was saying. You know, as I've talked to these young people this morning, you know, going around to their cars and hearing their backgrounds, it's interesting to me that it's not all engineering students. It includes liberal arts sort of students as well, but they all have a passion for doing things like this. And as Kurt said, they're competitive and they're bright and they're looking to the future, exactly the kind of people that we have in Black & Veatch and we want to have in Black & Veatch.
And one of the interesting things that I find is that the students that are involved in this race are very passionate about the new technology that they're trying to deploy and bringing, you know, these technically challenging projects and their innovations to life. And it's really great to see how they're doing that and applying what they've learned in school to bring these projects to life.
Yes, and what better place than Ann Arbor? Ann Arbor is a reputation, and the University of Michigan, Eastern Michigan University, for doing some amazing things in alternative energy and in sustainability in general. But the Black & Veatch facility here in Ann Arbor is a beautiful facility and the perfect place to do this sort of a thing. That must be part of the reason why you guys got involved.
It is. We are happy to open up our facilities here to this event. And hopefully, you know, the students will come away with an appreciation for Black & Veatch as a company.
You know, Black & Veatch has been involved in the solar space for about 40 years. And over that time, we've worked on literally thousands of projects that range from doing feasibility studies to conceptual designs, project development, project implementation through asset management. And since 2008, we've been doing the technical due diligence on over 4,000 megawatts of solar PV projects around the world. And some of the more notable projects that we've been involved in is in 2010, we worked on a project in Ontario called Sarnia Solar Project. It was an 80-megawatt project that at the time was the world's largest solar project in the world. We've also had the opportunity to work on the first solar PV projects in Thailand, India, and South Africa as well. So we're very proud of our participation in the solar space.
It's amazing what you're doing in the solar space, but even more amazing, I did a little bit of research on Black & Veatch, and the company's come a long way since its Kansas origins back in the early 1900s. Black & Veatch started a couple of friends at the University of Kansas. Black & Veatch got this thing going. You've grown to a global company now in a lot of space besides alternative energy, including water. A little bit about Black & Veatch for our listeners who may not be familiar with the company and your global reach.
You're right. Mr. Black and Mr. Veatch started the partnership in 1915. So in less than 3 years, we're going to be celebrating our centennial of Black and Veatch. And in order for a company like ours to grow and prosper like it has over that time frame, you have to continually reinvent yourself in the things that you do, your ownership structure. And right now, we're an employee-owned company. So the active people in the company actually own it. They're working for themselves, you could say, in a certain sense. We're in five critical infrastructure areas, one being water, water treatment, wastewater treatment, water resources, and we're in energy, all forms of power, energy generation, transmission and distribution, environmental. We're in telecommunications and doing a lot of deployment of the cutting-edge wireless technology throughout the United States, but now we're starting to do that internationally as well. We're in federal government, U.S. federal government work, particularly in the area of safety and security, but also in infrastructure in developing countries like Afghanistan and the West Bank and other parts of the world. And finally, management consulting, where we put together management expertise along with infrastructure development. So those are the five business areas that Black & Veatch is in.
Yeah, I spent quite a bit of time on your website, and it was amazing the projects that you folks are doing all over the world. And I think the telecommunications arm is relatively new compared to some of the others. But let's talk about the energy and water thing. I mean, Kurt, Director of Renewables, as Black & Veatch looks out over the next 10, 20, 30 years, I mean, where are we going with renewable energy, not only in the United States but across the globe? And what is your strategic planning telling you?
Well, we think that renewable energy is going to become and will continue to be an important play an important role in the generation portfolio that the world will require in the years ahead. And it's enjoyed, renewables in particular, has enjoyed tremendous growth here in the United States in the past decade. And we expect that to continue. Most of that has been driven by the federal government tax incentives as well as the state renewable portfolio standards. And just general public support has been a big driver in helping renewables. So, again, we believe that it's going to be an important part of the generation portfolio of our clients here in the U.S. as well as across the globe.
I got to ask you, because it's been much in the news lately, but China is really ramping up alternative energy. They're developing entire cities based on solar and other alternatives. You folks are global. I mean, you're perfect people to ask. China's serious about this, and the United States is going to be hard-pressed to keep up if we don't make some investments.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We need to continue to provide the incentives to allow the industry to continue to grow in the United States. I believe the solar industry in particular, the supply chain for it is well developed. The costs are being driven down constantly. There's been huge decreases in the cost of solar that are enabling it to become more and more competitive with other forms of technology. So I believe it's got a strong future.
If we could, Dean, let's come back to you, and let's talk just in general terms about water. Water is also much in the news, and there are those that are saying the water management, water conservation, water use may be the single most important sustainability problem we're facing over the next 50 years. Black & Veatch, you folks are into water as well. What is your strategic planning telling you about the whole water area?
Well, you're correct that increasingly this world is becoming water-stressed. You know, use of water, demand of water is directly tied to population, you know, where it is and how big it is. And if you look at the demographics of population growth in the world, it's in a lot of places that are very water-stressed. So we're going to have to put a lot of innovation into, you know, how we get water, how we use water. The way we are talking about water these days is water is water. You know, it doesn't have a prefix or a suffix, right? It's water. And so more and more technologies are getting into making it a closed-loop cycle, where the waste water from one process becomes the input of water for another process, more closed loops. You know, about 3% of the world's water is fresh water. Two-thirds of that is frozen into the polar ice caps. So the rest of it is in lakes and streams and reservoirs. And we need to be very careful with it.
Well, and a lot of that fresh water is right here in the great state of Michigan. And there's been a lot of talk, too, about why doesn't a state like Michigan, a Great Lakes state, use their expertise in water management to develop economic opportunities around the globe? It sounds like Black and Veatch has already thought through that. That's exactly what you folks are doing.
It's at least a regional issue to deal with. It becomes national, and in fact, it's a world problem to focus on.
Yeah, I'd like to add that, you know, there's a really unique nexus. We refer to it as a nexus between energy and water, because there is a strong interdependency between the two, because it takes a tremendous amount of water to produce energy, and it takes a tremendous amount of energy to obtain the water resources and provide them to the consumers. So we're constantly trying to increase the awareness of that interdependency and how valuable water is as a resource, and it needs to be valued as such.
As you folks look around the globe, and then I want to come back to the American Solar Challenge here, but real quickly here, I'll start with Dean. As you look at sustainability globally, what worries you the most right now? What keeps you up at night?
It's the institutional and political barriers that get in the way of implementing the solutions.
Kurt?
I agree with Dean and emphasize that, you know, there's a lot of talk about sustainability, but we really need to get into action and implement plans to become more conscious about our use of energy and water and how we need to make sure that there are the resources available to future generations that we enjoy today.
And last question, and most appropriate for the American Solar Challenge. And Dean, you mentioned that you've talked to a lot of these young people who are competing. When you meet young people like this, how do you feel about the future, and not only of sustainability, but of civilization in general?
The future looks good based on that.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged because, like I mentioned earlier, the participants in this event, they're, you know, really engaged with what they're doing. They're really passionate about coming up with new technology solutions for the future. And I think we can bank on that because America is known for its innovative ideas and solutions.
Well, there are a lot of things that Black and Veatch could sponsor and host, but I can't think of anything much better than this. I want to congratulate Black and Veatch. I've been talking with Dean Oskvig, who's president of Black and Veatch Energy, Kurt Westerman, senior vice president, director of renewables and energy efficiency at Black and Veatch. Thanks so much for your time, and best of luck going forward.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you for having us.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
We're the face of MSU across the state, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
MSU Ag Bio Research is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state.
MSU Ag Bio Research.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, we're in Ann Arbor for the beginning of the third stage of the 2012 American Solar Challenge. We've heard a little bit about the American Solar Challenge from the folks from Black and Veatch, but now we actually have the participants, and we have the Michigan-based participants. We've got some of the team members from the Western Michigan University team, and we have a team member as well from the University of Michigan. They are from Western Michigan University, Byron Eisenbard and Mitch Pennick. Byron and Mitch, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And from the University of Michigan, team captain Jordan Feit. Jordan, good to have you on the show.
Thanks a lot.
Let's start with you, Jordan. University of Michigan is the defending champion of the American Solar Challenge. And going into stage three here, I understand you folks are still back up, maybe leading it or near the top of the pack?
That is correct. We had some rain yesterday, but the engineering team was really good. I made sure that the car was really reliable, and the strategy team executed. We were able to power through some of the rain. That was actually 2 days ago. And we were able to get to the edge of the cloud line, hit some sun, and go back up to speed limit speeds.
How many people on your team? I understand it's faculty, administrators, and students. I mean, a lot of time, a lot of work. How many team members and how long have you been working on this car?
So right now there's about 19 people in our race crew. Essentially the team runs, just the students run the team. And this car was just raced in the World Solar Challenge in October. So we started design phase for this car about a year and a half ago.
Now, Jordan, for our listeners who are wondering, what are you majoring in at the University of Michigan and what are your career plans? And then we'll come back to the car in a second.
Well, I'm majoring in climate physics at the College of Engineering, and in terms of career, I'm not quite sure yet, but continuing education beyond my undergrad.
Now, back to the car, the Quantum. Tell our listeners a little bit. It's hard to visualize these cars. I mean, they're rather amazing, but give them a snapshot, maybe a verbal picture of what this car looks like. A lot of maize and blue on the thing.
Yeah, that's correct, and we do have the wings across the helmet. But the car is a very low, sleek car with an airfoil that's very flat across the top. So as you can imagine, it's kind of just like a solar array on wheels. And the car itself is extremely light. It's about 320 pounds, made entirely of carbon fiber.
320 pounds, and top end, if you've got a lot of good solar energy powering the car, how fast can it go?
Well, we haven't taken this car up to its maximum speed. The tires are only rated to 80. Our previous generation car, we were able to get up to 105, though.
105 miles an hour. So you got a driver in a 300-pound car going 105 miles an hour. Isn't that a little bit precarious?
Well, it's actually pretty cool. So the aerodynamically, we're able to maintain a really high level of stability at those speeds. So.
Now, you're competing. I think 12 teams started. There are 11 teams left going into this third stage. One of the teams you're competing against is Western Michigan University. Let's go to Byron Eisenbard. Byron, a little bit about the development of your car, how many people on the team down at Western, and your role.
Well, we've basically done a three-year design build cycle on this car and been progressing along with it since 2010. This car raced in ASC 2010, the American Solar Challenge. It also participated in Formula Sun Grand Prix 2011, and this year we are actually participating once again in American Solar Challenge 2012 with it. We've done some improvements to the car. We've got a new battery and some suspension upgrades to the car, and basically it's the same car we've used for the past few years, so we're going to be starting to do a new car for this next race.
Love the name of your car. I mean, most appropriately named, Sunseeker. Who came up with that?
Well, our team started 22 years ago, and I think we've almost forgotten who came up with it. So it's kind of a thing I've got to find out. Someone asked me that yesterday, and I'll get back to you on that one.
Now, you have a preliminary race, all the schools do, and it sort of gives you a placement in terms of the actual race. And Western Michigan University came in third, I guess. That's the best finish that you've had. So how's it looking so far in the race?
It's looking decent. We've had a couple of issues with some electrical problems, a couple mechanical things. We're always integrating the car with the new battery and everything like that. And the car performed extremely well during the Formula Sun Grand Prix. We qualified third. We qualified second for that event, and then that event we came in third place, which qualified us for this event in third place. We had a bit of rain issues the other day, so we're a little bit behind, but we're hoping to regain ground over the next few days.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. You're in this race, and the the sun stops shining and it begins to rain, how does the car, what powers the car at that point?
Well, at that point, the car can still take in a fair amount of solar energy, but it is at a reduced rate. So you have to slow down or speed up depending on if you actually want to break through the clouds or if you want to conserve energy. And then there's also a 20-kilogram lithium polymer battery pack in the car, which is very comparable to, say, a Leaf or a Chevy Volt. And that will actually give us around 100 to 150-mile range just on battery power alone. So you never want to deplete that fully, but, you know, that gives you that buffer.
You know, Byron, I've got a Chevy Volt, and I wish my lithium-ion battery would give me 150 miles, but it gives me about 45. Let's turn to your colleague, Mitch Penick. Mitch is actually driving the Sunseeker. What's that like, Mitch?
I like to think of driving the solar car kind of similar as going to going down a steep hill in a shopping cart. It's very uncomfortable and very warm, but it's definitely a very interesting experience that few people get to have.
Let's describe your car a little bit. What does it look like? How many photovoltaic cells? A little bit of the background on and the engineering of your car.
All of the cars in the field are very streamlined. We have a three-wheel design with two motors in the front, which is kind of unusual for the field. It's designed to minimize wind resistance while it's cutting through the air while having the maximum exposure to the sun on top.
Mitch, when you're driving this thing, what do you worry about, if anything? I mean, besides the sun shining, of course.
Drivers have to pay attention to just mainly the mechanical workings of the car. We usually have telemetry monitoring all of the electronics on the other end, so the driver mainly just needs to be aware of if there's any strange noises coming from the car or if there's any strange behavior coming from the car.
Now, I asked our friend from the University of Michigan, Jordan Feit, what he was going to do with his career and his major. I'll ask you guys the same thing. Mitch, what are your plans down the road?
I'm studying industrial and entrepreneurial engineering, so I'm hoping to get a job in industry, hopefully just working on the quality end of things and helping companies improve their product.
And how about you, Byron?
Well, my degree is going to be in electrical engineering, and with the, you know, the car and everything like that, I've looked at getting into battery protection systems and automotive, also some medical stuff, because a lot of medical tools use batteries and everything like that. So there's a lot of carryover between several industries, so hopefully I can apply that.
I'm going to ask all of you the same question. I'm sure you're grateful for all the sponsors. It's amazing the number of sponsors, but Black & Veatch being a major sponsor of this event. But what do you think in terms of your careers and life skills are the biggest things that you're going to take away from this competition? And we'll start with Jordan.
Well, one of the coolest things of being on the team is actually just being able to integrate with all the different disciplines of engineering. So where you might come in as electrical or mechanical, you'll start learning all the other disciplines. So just a broad understanding of engineering as a whole is really awesome, and taking that away is extremely marketable, as you can imagine. And, you know, that's one of the coolest things of being on the team.
Okay, let's go to Byron. What's the biggest thing you're going to take away from this that's going to help you with your career and your life skills?
Well, basically, being able to walk away from a project like this, you know, having gone through the full starting out as a freshman and then progressing all the way through, going into management and doing full design of projects, basically, it's, you know, I don't know how many people can come out of school with having completed a project saying, I've done this and I've also managed this team successfully. So that's a huge thing.
And Mitch?
I think dealing with the team dynamics as we overcome various obstacles is a very relevant thing to industry. I think there's a lot of people that don't gain the experience of working in a team while working on a project as much as in this event.
Last question I got to ask. You Broncos from Western Michigan, are you going to dethrone the Maize and Blue this year?
We sure hope to.
And from the Maize and Blue perspective, what are the chances that you'll keep your crown?
Well, we're going to do everything we can to keep that.
I've been talking with three students who are involved in the American Solar Challenge who have very bright futures ahead of them. Jordan Feit from the University of Michigan, Byron Eisenbard, and Mitch Penick from Western Michigan University. Congratulations to the three of you for doing something that's over and above what one might do with a regular curriculum, and best of luck going forward. May the best solar car win.
Thanks a lot. Much appreciated.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the Michigan State University Alumni Association. And if you're the parent of a Spartan, there's no better gift you can give than a lifetime membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. Joining the MSUAA family opens the doors to our network of over 500,000 Spartans who'll help you feel right at home wherever you go, who can help connect you with Spartans on the inside, who can help you grow in your career. People who give you special treatment just because you're a Spartan. And an investment in a life membership in the MSU Alumni Association doesn't just add value to your Spartan life. It helps Spartans everywhere build more competitive skill sets and move more quickly in the direction of their dreams. Learn more about an MSUAA life membership online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
The University Research Corridor, empowering Michigan.
Well, the University Research Corridor is a collaboration among Michigan State University, University of Michigan, and Wayne State.
That's Michigan State University President Luana Simon.
People of Michigan have made an extraordinary investment in us, but no institution can do everything. And we need to use our visibility and our cachet to advance the state of Michigan and its people. And the URC is a vehicle to do that.
Visit us online at urcmich.org.
It's not that it's the only game in town, but it is a game in town that brings, we hope, a spotlight to Michigan and also tells the people of Michigan that we are committed to using the investment they've made in us to try to move the state forward.
Visit the University Research Corridor online at urcmich.org.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's not a coincidence that Ann Arbor would be hosting the American Solar Challenge of 2012 because Ann Arbor is well known in its own right as a solar city. And to talk a little bit about that, it's a pleasure to welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes Ann Arbor Mayor John Heefscha, who was first elected in the year 2000 and reelected every 2 years since. Mayor, great to see you here at the American Solar Challenge. You must be proud not only of the University of Michigan team, but the fact that Ann Arbor is hosting this leg of the competition.
Oh, we're really, really excited about it, and thank you for having me on today. It was a pleasure to come out here and be able to wave the flag for these guys. They do so much work on it. It's just amazing, the technology, and our whole city, if you look at our industry, if you look at our government, we're invested in technology and innovative technology. These folks are doing it. We're invested in solar to a certain extent. We'd love to invest more, but it really points up a lot of things for me. You can do solar here in Michigan. They're racing across the state today on SunPower. It's just amazing.
You know, on this show, we featured a lot of events in Ann Arbor. Just recently, we did a segment on Mission Zero Fest that you're very familiar with. But Ann Arbor was named a solar city not too long ago. And what are some of the solar initiatives specifically, Mayor, that you're doing in town?
Well, the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, named 25 solar cities USA. And, you know, you would expect some of them are in Arizona. But there are a couple. There's Madison, Wisconsin, and Ann Arbor, Michigan up here. And we're just proving that you can make solar work. We heat all of our swimming pools, all of our hot water for the fire stations, City Hall, all of those things. That's solar. But what we've done over the last few years is a really big program to reduce our energy usage. So we hit in 2010 by reducing our energy, bringing on, we use landfill gas, we use everything we can get. We're running city government on 20% renewable energy. So that's a goal that very, very few cities can meet. And you wouldn't think we do it here in the Midwest, but we're doing it.
And if I'm not mistaken, you have a goal of running the entire city on renewable 20% by 2015. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're not going to hit that one, but it's a goal that's out there. We don't have the power to bring the whole community along, but we're continuing to work. We've had a challenge out there to anybody who wants to bring us Michigan-based wind power. We'll even pay a little more for it so that we can use it to run our water treatment and wastewater treatment. And then, of course, we think in a long-term contract, it'll come out in our favor.
Mayor Heefscha, what do you think about these renewable portfolio standards? There's a ballot initiative coming up pretty soon that wants to ramp those up. I know some of the utility companies are a bit skeptical about those goals, but in general, do these renewable portfolio standards really push the envelope?
I think they do push the envelope a little bit, but I think that's a really good thing. One of the concerns I have is that we're not looking far enough into the future. One of the things I've always tried to do as mayor, and I think our city has always tried to do, is what's going to be in place 15, 20, 30 years down the road. And we have got to start looking at that future. We've got to start looking at the constraints on fossil fuels. You know, there's some of the same countries that are saying right now that maybe warming is not a real thing, are planning on opening up a route through the Arctic for shipping year-round. So those are the types of things that we need to be taking a look at. But also on the energy side, America is very dependent on foreign energy. The natural gas boom, if we can do it cleanly, is going to help. But we need to be exploring these new sources of energy, and it's also a really good place to grow jobs.
The whole natural gas issue is an interesting one, and Michigan is really quite the repository for natural gas, as you well know. We also have tremendous storage capacity for natural gas, but fracking is an issue, and I think you said it best. If we can do it right, if we can monitor it, some states haven't been as successful doing that.
Yeah, it's an industry that is crying out for more regulation. I hate to say that, but you've got to be able to assure people that by bringing this energy up, we're not going to pollute your water. I mean, water is water, and we all need it. We need energy, too, but I think water is even more basic.
My guest is Ann Arbor Mayor John Heftcha. I want to talk to you about another one of your green initiatives that I know a little bit about, and that's the Parks and Green Belt Initiative in Ann Arbor, a major initiative that you've been championing for some time now. An update on that.
Well, I was one of the leaders of the campaign back in 2003, and our voters agreed to tax themselves. It's not a lot. It's a half mil, and we have a 30-year program to preserve farmland around the city. It's always going to be farmland. We're seeing hoop houses going up out there. We're seeing people growing food right here in southern Michigan, probably about 11 months a year that they're working out there in those hoop houses. We've guaranteed local agriculture forever, and again, we're looking to a future when we could have been completely sprawled over. Michigan uses up land at a very fast rate. And we're looking at a future. What's it going to mean when fuel constraints mean maybe your vegetables aren't coming from South America? We're looking for a future where we have 11, 12 months a year of farming right here in southern Michigan.
Yeah, agriculture is a story that a lot of people aren't too familiar with. I know down here in Washtenaw County you have been doing farmland preservation. There's some of that going on in Ingham County and up in the Grand Rapids area as well. Let's turn to something that, because you're in the same neck of the woods as Governor Snyder or where he's from, and he has a history with the Nature Conservancy around here, we haven't heard too much from this administration about environmental initiatives, green initiatives. What's your take on that? Will it happen? Is that not a priority? I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but what is the story with the Snyder administration in terms of moving some of the Granholm initiatives forward?
Well, I think that the field is wide open, and it would be advisable from a whole lot of viewpoints for the Snyder administration to move forward on some of these green initiatives. They can certainly start some of their own. I think protection of the Great Lakes has always got to be at the top of the list. But this renewable energy area has a great potential. The governor talks about jobs a lot, and I think that he's certainly a really smart guy. He ought to see what can be done here. I know Rick, and I'm hopeful that when he can take his focus a little bit off of what he's had to focus on and trying to fix some budget things, and again, I don't always agree with the governor, but there's some. The governor, for instance, is very good on transit, and I think that's another one of those things that as we look down the road, we need to have a way to get our people to their jobs. 68,000 people come to work in Ann Arbor every single day from somewhere else. We need to be able to get them here without their cars, on a train, with better bus routes. We need to start solving these problems for the future. Fuel costs, any way you look at it, are going to be much higher in the future.
Well, Mr. Mayor, there's no secret that state resources and federal resources are scarce these days. And the things you're doing in Ann Arbor, and there are some other cities in Michigan that are doing some great things. I mean, how much of all of this, your green initiatives, your energy initiatives, et cetera, it's got to come from the grassroots, it's got to come from the people in the community.
Well, it's got to come from the people in the community, but the city of Ann Arbor is blessed with people who really care about these long-term issues. And the other thing I would put it to is, you know, our green initiatives are actually saving the city government money, and people don't tend to look at it that way, but it's true. We also have the PACE program that allows our businesses to green up, and many of them are taking advantage of that. Property Assessed Clean Energy, we're the only city in the state with that, and we worked with the legislature to make that happen. But all of these things can come together. They don't necessarily mean an outlay. They can actually save you money and create jobs, and move our state into a better, cleaner future.
And, you know, for some of those environmental groups that may be a little bit averse to any kind of development whatsoever, I mean, we've been doing a lot of programming on LEED certified businesses, exactly what you were talking about, businesses that are willing to come in, do things right, conserve energy, be good citizens, and still create jobs. They're not mutually exclusive.
Well, that's it, and I think the business community can really pick up on that. Again, we have a lot of people taking part in our programs, but the bottom line is green can really save you a lot of money. Being efficient is the way to go. If you go to a factory in Japan or if you go to a factory in Europe, I've heard that 30, 40, even 50% more efficient in their use of energy. We need that here in the United States. We need it throughout city government. We need it in the state. I don't know why every street light that is installed isn't a light-emitting diode. It's worked very well for us. They pay for themselves in 4 years, and they continue to pay for themselves for the next 20 years.
And the last thing, again, Ann Arbor is hosting this leg of the American Solar Challenge. You've had a chance to talk to some of these young people who are involved in this fantastic competition. The future seems pretty bright when you talk to these young people, doesn't it?
Well, the future seems unlimited, and technology can come along and really help us with a lot of the challenges. It's there. Again, I think that we just have to kind of pick it up and run with it. But these folks are going to lead us into the future. We've got to start planning our cities. We've got to start planning our transportation systems and our energy grid. We've got to start planning it with these folks in mind because they're going to be taking over from us.
My guest has been Mayor John Hiefcha, mayor of the great city of Ann Arbor. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, one of the things we want listeners to know is how connected we are, that we're in a response mode of addressing real life problems in the real world here in Michigan.
Dr. Steve Pepke leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
Well, we're everywhere. We're the face of MSU across the state, in the local communities, with infrastructure and research expertise to address those local problems. MSU Ag Bioresearch is the research engine that undergirds the food and agricultural industry in the state, that undergirds our natural resource usage, recreational usages of sport, fishing, forestry, all of those things. And of course, with the recent interest in renewable energy, we have in a very big way moved into this arena as well.
MSU Ag Bioresearch.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.